Hello and welcome to the Outdoor Lives podcast. My name is Mike Rain, author of Nature of Snowdonia and the forthcoming The Mountain Leader. The podcast is free to air, ad-free and music-free. You can find out more about me, my workshops and e-learning modules at www.mikerain.co.uk. My guest today is Lucy Wallace. Lucy is a mountain leader, winter mountain leader, international mountain leader. She's president of the Scottish Ramblers. She's a trainer and assessor of mountain leaders. She's part of the Mountain Rescue Team in Arran, but interestingly, she's also a former employee of RSPB, where she was the engagement officer for hen harriers. So I'm sure Lucy will have lots of interesting things to talk to us today about. I should also say this is coming from Arran. Lucy lives on Arran, which is, I don't know anybody who lives on Arran. That's quite interesting. So welcome to the podcast, Lucy. How are you today?
Hi, Mike. I'm fine. Yeah, great to be talking to you this morning. Thanks for inviting me on.
Thank you. Well, we must start by finding out how you end up living on Arran.
So I've been on Arran for ages now. I moved here in 2005.
Wow.
But I've not obviously not always been here, and I'm not from Arran. So I was living in South Wales before I moved here, working in an outdoor shop and loving life. But I think I wanted to be a little bit nearer to the mountains. My boyfriend at the time, now husband, is an outdoor instructor, and he was looking to kind of make a bit of a move as well. So he got a job working for an outdoor centre on Arran, and we both moved up, and I got a job working in reception and the outdoor centre taking bookings. It seems like a very long time ago.
Yeah. So you've worked through your qualifications while you've been an Arran, have you?
Yeah. So I didn't ever really intend to be an outdoor instructor when I started out as a grown up with a proper job. And the outdoor centre on Arran put me through my ML training. And I'll be honest with you, I was literally just making up the numbers because I needed another person on the course so they could run it. So they sent me on this course, and I really enjoyed it. Sadly, the outdoor centre, like a lot of outdoor centres, shut down, but I stayed on Arran and worked my way through my qualifications. And here we are.
Well, I guess you have to travel quite a lot for work then, do you?
I do. And it's kind of, I love traveling, but I also find it, you know, it's one of the challenges is having to be away from home a lot and juggling ferries and logistics and dog care and that kind of thing. But Arran is a lovely place to come home to. And there is some work here. So I have my own little business on Arran as well. It's easy to get to the lakes from where I am. So I spend a lot of time working in the lakes or in the Scottish Highlands.
I think easy is relative. Easy is relative, isn't it, Lucy? You've got at least one ferry, haven't you?
Yeah, if the boat's running, it's not too bad. If the boat isn't running, then it's a complete deal breaker.
So it must be a nice place to go home to. Are you in a village or a community there? Do you have a baker's and all that sort of thing? Or?
I'm in Lamlash, which is a lovely, quite large, vibrant village with lots of pubs and a little shop. It's a beautiful bay and it looks out over Holy Isle. And it is actually just a fantastic place to live. I'm very lucky.
Sounds good. So tell us about the work you do, Lucy. Is it all mountain leading work, international mountain leading work, winter mountain leading work? Where do you do that? Who do you do that for? What sort of things do you get up to and whereabouts, I guess?
I'm so lucky because my work is really, really diverse. And I quite often introduce myself as the archetypal jobbing mountain leader because I've kind of been there, done that, got the T-shirt. Mm. But at the moment, it's a mixture of my own business, which is actually mostly wildlife guiding with a little bit of mountains thrown in. And that's based on Arran. I do a little bit of DOV. And in the past, I've done a lot of DOV work, actually. And it's work that I really, really enjoy. And I work for an ML provider down in the Lake District, Graham Uni Mountaineering. And I work on a lot of his courses, which is fantastic. And kind of Brexit and COVID have sort of dampened the international side of things for me. But I'm actually just about to start a new role, which will see me working out in Tanzania and Switzerland over the next year. So that's quite exciting. So I'm looking forward to getting back out there with that.
That's leading, really groups, leading groups there, is it?
Yeah, so we'll be working with groups of young people in northern Tanzania over the winter. And then the company's got a base out in Switzerland as well. So should be heading out there this summer. I cannot wait. Yeah.
Will it be wildlife guiding there or mountain leading there or a bit of both?
So it's going to be primarily mountain leading sort of facilitating work, project work, charity work, particularly in Tanzania. But I'm obviously really looking forward to safari. It's going to be fantastic.
But if we came over to Aaron to see some wildlife and you were guiding us, I know you've got an interest in hen harriers, and we're very lucky to have a pair of hen harriers at the back of my house here, which is very special. Yeah, yeah, but nowhere near the numbers you've got. So what sort of wildlife would you guide us around?
Oh, so Aaron's got, so Scotland's got its own big five. And Aaron, you can see all five of them. And interestingly, it doesn't include the hen harrier, but we've got grey seals and common seals on Aaron. We have red squirrels, we have otters, we have red deer, and we have golden eagles. But as you say, we also have quite a special population of hen harriers. We've got between 25 and 30 breeding pairs, varies a little bit from year to year. And you can see them all around the island, and quite easily, in fact. You don't have to kind of trek into the wilds to see them. They're often seen kind of drifting along by the roadsides, hunting voles. So it's one of the best places I've ever been to see hen harriers. Really special.
That slightly reminds me of being in a Kilty Buoy up beyond Ullapool there and driving along the single track road, and there was a car parked in the middle of the road. And then we saw a gentleman just a few yards away with binoculars, and he was French, and he was saying, "Seagull, seagull." So we joined in, you know, and I guess it's a bit like that, Aaron, isn't it? We would never get anywhere. We'd be stopping the car all the time to look at things.
It can be a little bit like that. The classic one on Aaron is people just stopping dead in the middle of the road because they've seen a seal, and you know they're fresh off the boat because honestly there's so many seals. And they just stop, and their hands go out the window and they're pointing. But it's great. I mean, it's a fantastic place for people to kind of really get in touch with their wild side and kind of see things that maybe they've never seen before.
And at this time of year, do you have the island to yourselves? Is it locals only?
It's pretty quiet just now. November's our quietest month. It's very wet and very windy and a bit dark, but it's still beautiful. It is still beautiful. It's probably also the quietest time for wildlife as well. So everything's kind of calming down.
Are there many woods? Do you get autumn colours?
Yeah, so we've got a tiny little bit of the old kind of Scottish rainforest on the northwest coast of the island, which is gorgeous, but a little bit unloved. And to be honest, it would be great to see that that thriving more than it is. But there's also a lot of kind of more recent regenerated woodland that's springing up around the island, which is really good to see. There's some ancient woods around Brodick, and the autumn colours there are great. We've got red squirrels throughout the island.
Great. So living in what to most of us is the middle of nowhere, having to travel to work, how do you come to be working as an ML trainer and ML assessor? That's quite a step from looking at squirrels on Aaron and doing a few DV with the kids.
You know, when I first did my ML, right back in God knows when, 2007 or something, I thought, you know, the pinnacle of someone's career could be training and assessing future leaders. I was so inspired by the people that I met doing it, the other instructor, you know, the instructors on the courses. And it's just something that I've always aspired to. And I think in my heart, I've always been kind of working towards, but I didn't really know that I was, because I didn't think that it was something that I could do for quite a long time. And then actually it was Alan Hailwood. I had a bit of a chat with Al Hailwood one day, and he was like, "You should do your IML, Lucy." And I was like, "Why?" He said, "Well, obviously you can work abroad, but actually it might open doors for you in this area as well, because it's one of the higher awards." And that was actually what kind of set me on the pathway to my IML, was a desire to work on summer mountain leader courses. Not a desire to work overseas, ironically. Although working overseas is a huge bonus.
It does help. Yeah, I'm an IML, but I haven't actually used it as an IML since I've passed it, I don't think. But we try to travel as little as possible. That's not something you can do, is it?
No.
What are the challenges with working on MLs? I mean, if people are listening, you know, be a lot of mountain leaders listening now, what advice would you want them to pass on to trainees? You know, how do you want people to turn up ready for training or ready for assessment?
So I think sometimes people get in a bit of a muddle and think that, you know, they've got to be proficient with ropes and things like that before they come on training, and they perhaps overthink it a little bit. So I think for people coming on training courses, I would say remember that it's a training course. You'll learn a lot of the technical skills on the course that you need to know, and you'll be given really good signposts for anything else that you can follow up. What will benefit someone coming on a training course really is having a little bit of just experience in the hills under your belt. So just being able to kind of manage your kit a little bit and kind of get a little bit cold and wet. Because it's a 6-day course, and inevitably you're going to get cold and wet on the course. And I think sometimes people that have done a bit more hill walking, you're supposed to do your 20 QMDs before you come, and people who've got that 20 QMDs when they come tend to get more out of the training course, because the learning environment is easier for them, because they're, you know, they've got a bit of capacity.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And for assessment, it's kind of the same thing really, as don't sell yourself short by only doing the minimum of QMDs. The candidates that do well are ones that are really comfortable in the mountain environment, and that's because they've spent a lot of time being cold and wet. And so go out and get your QMDs and enjoy yourself doing them, but also don't just do it on the easy days. Go out and get cold and wet, and be my advice.
Yeah, it's good advice, isn't it? I hate it, getting cold and wet, but it is good advice. And it's not all about cold and wet. It's just about being able to cope with it when you do get cold and wet, isn't it? Most of the time we're not cold and we're not wet. But when it comes, you've got to be able to manage, haven't you? Cool. And now you've got this interesting role, Lucy, it's an honorary role, I know that, but you're the president of the Scottish Ramblers. How do you come to be the president of the Scottish Ramblers, and what does that involve?
Oh, so about 3 years ago, I got a phone call out of the blue. In fact, it was just before Christmas, and I was decorating the Christmas tree at the time. It was one of those "where were you when" moments. So I'll never forget it. And Brendan Paddy, who's Rambler Scotland director, called me up and asked me whether I would be interested in becoming the president of Rambler Scotland. And I had to take a bit of a seat afterwards, to be honest, and kind of go, "Oh my God, where did that come from?" Because it was quite unexpected. And I had to give it a lot of thought before I accepted. I'm the first female Rambler Scotland president. And although, you know, 2/3 of our members are women, Rambler Scotland hasn't seen that many women in leadership roles. So I think it was quite a big step for them as well. Brendan was very keen to have me on board, and he was really supportive. And I think that they've been kind of trying to move away from having grandees as figureheads, but actually people who are kind of more like their members and perhaps a bit more relatable and a little bit more normal. So my predecessor, Ben Dolphin, is a fantastic, fantastic bloke. And he's kind of really passionate about the outdoors and nature, and he's an excellent communicator. And so I think they were kind of continuing that journey with me. I'm in my final year, actually. So there'll be somebody new coming in the spring, which will be exciting, definitely.
It sounds as though you've enjoyed it. It's been rewarding. What have you done, and why has it been rewarding?
I started at the start of the pandemic. initially, I have been a little bit. I kind of had to stay at home, and I did a bit of writing, and it was an interesting time because I think members, we couldn't walk together, so members were spending a lot of time walking in their local area and perhaps exploring their local area in ways that they hadn't before. So that was a very, very exciting time in a strange way, because people changed the way that they were walking. People walked who'd never walked before, and people who were used to traveling to the Highlands and climbing Munros and things like that were finding themselves having to explore closer to home. So but part of my role at that point was really just about sort of communicating those feelings and emotions, and trying to kind of keep the organization together so that people didn't feel like we were walking completely in solitude. So that was interesting. More recently, as the world has opened up, I've been able to go out and kind of meet people and get a bit more involved, which has been great. I recently went to the opening of the Magnificent 11, which is a new long distance route around Glasgow, new walking route. So that was fantastic. Again, that's kind of continuing in that vein, really, of walking closer to home and exploring our local area a bit more.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really important that we get people out walking. We need to make it more accessible, don't we? Local walks need to be clear, signposts, good footpaths, to encourage people to walk on them. It's certainly a big topic, I think. Lucy, you said you're the first female president of the Scottish Ramblers. I'm just checking my calendar here. It's 2022. Why are we still talking about first female this and first female that? What's happening?
It's quite surprising, isn't it? When Brendan told me, I admit that I was quite shocked. I'm definitely not going to be the last, that's for sure. I think things are really changing. I think we've seen a sea change in the last 10 years with more and more women kind of coming through into the outdoor industry and putting themselves forward into leadership roles. When I first started, I frequently felt like I was the only woman in the room, but that has changed so much. There's so many talented women out there now in our industry coming through, and it's really exciting to see how things are changing.
Yeah, there is still a minority, isn't it, females, and I think we ought to be working towards 50%. What advice would you have for women who are thinking about going down the route of being a leader, route of being an instructor? They just need a sort of boost in the confidence sometimes. What advice would you have for those people?
I think having confidence in yourself is definitely part of it. It's very typical. We talk about women kind of lacking confidence and perhaps over preparing for things. But I don't actually think that's any bad thing if you're very prepared for assessments and if you are kind of diligent in your work. And I think that's what makes women such capable leaders, actually. But just knowing that you belong, knowing that you have as much right to be there as anybody else. And it is definitely something that's changing. I was recently at the Women in Mountain Training Conference at Placid Brennan, and it was just fantastic because there were so many fantastic, talented women there, and actually so many that are not lacking in confidence, that they are actually kind of bold and proud of what they do. And again, I really think that's a change that we're seeing, and I'm really excited by it.
Yeah, it's good to see, isn't it? And I think there's a realisation that there's not one easy, quick fix. Not all women prepare well, and not all women lack confidence, because like men, they're all different. And there are lots of different factors involved, because we're people, aren't we? And we need to treat people as individuals. Some happen to be male and some happen to be female. And I think that's a really interesting area for people to think about.
I really agree. And, you know, one of the take homes for me from going to the Women in Mountain Training Conference was that as we see more women coming through into the industry, we're actually seeing our qualifications being used in different ways that perhaps they haven't been used before. Mm. That I also think is really exciting. You know, people are doing their mountain lead, and not just because they want to teach navigation or kind of lead people up Ben Nevis or whatever, but you know, they're wanting to lead art workshops in wild spaces, or they're, you know, they're kind of interested in working with mental health. So the more diverse our industry is, actually, the stronger it is, I think, in terms of its kind of performance and its reach. So it's really good.
Yeah, it is. It's excellent to see. I think like myself, though, your interest is probably strongly in the nature, isn't it? Strongly in being in these beautiful wild places, seeing beautiful things. Now, it's easy to take this both ways and say, oh, my goodness, the hills are denuded, they're overgrazed, there's too many deer, it's a terrible state of affairs. But all across, and, you know, I cycle through Scotland in May, and there's a lot of dull glens, but there's an awful lot of places where there's some regeneration going on, where there are glimmers of hope. How do you feel when you travel through the Scottish Highlands and maybe then to the Lake District? You know, what are the concerns? What are the threats? But what are the good bits as well?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right, Mike. It does depend on where you are, and there are no doubt there are corners of Scotland that I go through and I just kind of go, oh God, if only they could do it differently here. But also there are absolutely stunning, magical places, places which have been preserved and protected, but there are also places where change is happening. And we can see it in our lifetime. So for example, I work quite a bit in the Swindale area. And since I've started working down there, Swindale in the Lake District,
where
Haweswater is. Haweswater, that's right. Yeah. We've seen the re-wiggling of the beck there, and the tree planting, and it's the valley is just bursting with life, and it's really exciting seeing these kind of landscape changes that are happening. I think we need to trumpet them from the highest treetops and mountaintops, really, and encourage as many landowners as possible to kind of listen and take on board what's happening, because it's very exciting.
Yeah, one of our early podcasts was with Lee Schofield, and the book Wild Fell is out there now, isn't it? So I'm sure, yeah, like me, you'd recommend Wild Fell as a book to read.
Definitely. Yeah.
There are conflicting bits of information. I was listening to BBC Wales podcast this week, and two farmers were having to stop harvesting bracken off the hillside, which they were using for bedding for their animals. And he said this is really sad because it just means that the hill's going to go wild. We're already starting to see trees popping up there. And I'm listening to this thinking, that sounds pretty good, really. But how do we close those gaps? How do we talk to people who are coming from such different backgrounds to that we've researched?
That's a really interesting question. I think as humans, we quite often kind of cling to what we know, don't we? And things that feel comfortable and familiar for us. We've got a similar interesting conversation happening here on Arran. So the National Trust for Scotland are involved in a massive landscape scale project to bring woodland back into Glenrosa, which is really exciting. There's been a huge amount of tree planting happening. And at the same time, there's been some pretty big fences that have gone in, that have fenced off a huge area to exclude the deer. And initially there was quite a bit of pushback, particularly from older members of the community who are, you know, the landscape, as far as they're concerned, has always been the way that it is. And they were worried that it would spoil the views and things like that. I think now that that conversation has actually moved on and people are much more on board with it all, what we're seeing, particularly with the exclusion of the deer, is actually not just the planted trees growing, but we're seeing things coming through that must have been there all along. So globe flower is a new record for Rosa, but wow, for globe flower to have popped up, it must have been there all the time, and it must have been being suppressed by the deer. And those kinds of things are very reassuring, really, that, you know, we're on the right track if we're seeing these plants starting to thrive. So I think that's what I would say is give it time, and perhaps you'll see a more healthy, vibrant landscape emerge.
You've got to take the communities with you, though, haven't you? It's not, you can't go in and tell them what to do. It's a gradual process, isn't it?
It is, yes. Yeah, I think absolutely.
Lee Schofield does talk about that in Wildfell, and James Rebank in English Pastoral, they talk about those journeys. So if we come over to Arran, I know there's, I've got the name of it now, there's a hard rock route and a classic rock route, and is it Goatfell? Where are the quiet bits? Where should we go on Arran when we come and visit?
I'm not telling you.
That's a really good answer. That's a really good answer.
So, you know, Goatfell via the main path up from Brodick is really busy. But if you're a bit more adventurous, there are lots of other ways to get to the summit of Goatfell, which is our highest mountain. And they're all beautiful. They are all really beautiful.
Do all the ridges have little paths on, or are they pathless?
So all the other approaches to Goatfell really have got sort of challenges, I would say. They're not for novice walkers. They're sort of scrambly exposed bits. There are paths, but there's a bit of route finding involved, so you need to have a little bit of experience. And some of the approaches are fairly challenging. If you go up from the saddle and along Stackhack Ridge, you'll encounter quite a lot of rock, all walking, but quite kind of exposed in places. And not always with a good path.
Great, thank you, Lucy. I think we've covered quite a lot of things there in very interesting manner. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we close?
Genuinely, Arran's lovely, and there's lots of quiet bits, and there's no bad bits. So do come up and come and enjoy the island, because it's I'm very proud of it. It's lovely.
It's on the ever lengthening list. Lucy Wallace, thank you very much. Thank you for talking to us today.
You're welcome. Thanks, Mike.